Hello, everyone, and welcome to the American Immigration Lawyers Association's podcast entitled Ethical Dilemmas When Representing Business Clients. I'm JJ Area, AILA's Education and Resources Associate, and it is my pleasure to introduce today's panel. The discussion leader for this podcast is Lynn Calder from Raleigh, North Carolina. Joining Lynn is Rick Gump from Dallas, Texas, and Tom Mason, the chair of Harris, Wiltshire & Grannis LLP's Legal Ethics and Malpractice Group from Washington, D.C. The speakers have selected some written materials for this podcast, which can be found in your AILA Agora digital library. Go to agora.aila.org and make sure you're signed in. On the top right of the page, you'll see a green button that says My Digital Library. Once on the page for your digital library, you'll see two files. One is the audio file and right above or below a resources file. If you have any questions, you can email agora@aila.org. At this time, I'd like to turn the podcast over to Lynn.
Thanks so much, JJ. Welcome to our discussion today of ethical dilemmas when you're representing business clients. And I'm here on this recording with Rick Gump from Dallas and Tom Mason from Washington, D.C. As JJ mentioned, we're going to talk about generally these ethical problems and the rules that apply to them. Tom is an expert on these ethical rules. We all would like to think of ourselves as experts on these rules, but know that we have to look them up. Tom is one of those guys that can throw them out off the top of his head. And Rick Gump, who has been practicing immigration law for a long time, as I have. So we'll talk about real-world scenarios as well as these rules that we all wish we had memorized. To start with, we want to make the point that your retainer agreement or letter of engagement when you're representing business clients is probably your most important tool in avoiding an ethical conflict and avoiding getting yourself into a situation where you're representing someone that you wish that you were not representing. There are a number of problems and issues that can come up that can be covered with the retainer agreement and or engagement letter, beginning with the question of who is your client and what's your scope of representation. In business situations, often you're put in a position of needing to represent both the employer and the employee in a filing for status, and it can cause a conflict unless you have specifically set out the parameters in writing with these two individuals, these two entities. So, Rick, would you like to start and just explain for a moment how this dual representation arises when representing business clients in the real world?
Well, it can happen in a number of ways. A couple of quick comments, just introductory here. I always apply the rules to the facts, not vice versa. So if you just read the rules first and then go into the facts, you're going to get very, very confused. The rules are based on reasonableness and communication. Our ethics group in Texas very recently gave a talk and indicated that 90% of the ethics violations occur because of improper communication. So just to throw that out there. In the world of immigration, business immigration, the dual representation appears in really a number of ways. If you're filing an H-1B or a perm, you've got an employer and an employee. Generally speaking, attorneys represent both the employer and the employee. Every once in a while, you'll have a separate lawyer for the employee. It is still difficult for the person who is presenting the petition not to be representing both and being able to disclose anything and everything that relates to that H-1B to the prospective employee. In addition, It pops up in the M&A, the merger and acquisition context, as well as the EB-5 context. In the merger context, it tends to appear where you've got a seller and a buyer who, let's just use the example of I-9 verification. If the seller is wanting to sell a group of employees, basically, and that's what the buyer is looking for, and there's not an audit done of the I-9s, then you can end up with a problem. We have had that issue in dual representation where both the seller and the buyer wanted to hire us to handle the I-9 verification, and we had to change our retainer agreement, get complete consent, because both of them wanted us, and even though we had to tell the buyer and seller that it was going to take another probably 6 months for them to clean up their act in order to complete the transaction. But it was done successfully because we communicated, they agreed. While that's unusual, that is the way that it worked. In EB-5, the investor visas, you've got regional centers sometimes. You have developers and you have investors. They all have different interests, and you'd better be careful in your representation because the Securities and Exchange Commission is increasingly investigating these types of securities, which is exactly what they are. So I'll leave it at that, Lynn.
Thanks, Rick. So, Tom, does dual representation just cause a nightmare for ethics attorneys such as yourself?
Well, I mean, I don't know. I think it can. It's their immigration is a classic example of a situation where it makes sense. And I don't think that the ethics rules should sort of dictate to the legal and business communities, you know, everything that they do, and say that, you know, you can't run into this. You can't have a situation where the employee, every situation where you have an employer and an employee and they're working on an adjustment of status for the employee that will benefit the employer, either as a new hire or later on, that you have to have separate lawyers, and that the employee has got to pay for his own lawyer, or the employer, if they pay for the employee's lawyer, has got to pay for two lawyers. So the ethics rules just have some they regulate the process, and they say that you've got to treat both clients co-equally. You can't keep secrets between one client vis-a-vis another client. And you have to make sure that their goals and objectives are, you know, consistent with the employer as the same wants to do the same thing and get this and accomplish the same, you know, work with the immigration authorities as the employee. And so it's really a basic idea of, you know, making sure everyone understands that there can be tugs on the lawyer in different directions from time to time, in the direction of the employer and the direction of the employee, but that's not going to sort of influence the basic loyalty that the attorney's going to have on behalf of both. And it really does come back to communication, which is what Rick is saying, is to communicate with the people who you're representing, what it means to be not the only client, and B, during the course of the representation, to tell them what's going on and to tell them the significance of particular events, and keep them updated as to what the prospects are in terms of timing, in terms of result, and so forth. So, you know, you can run into a problem when, and ensure just to jump into a slightly different area of immigration, you know, when you're handling, you know, family-based immigration matters, when families sort of break up or have disagreements, and you can have that same problem here in business with business clients and their employees, but you can manage it. I think to a great extent, you can't manage it
when the business is, and when you have the same situation that you have in the family-based immigration stuff, where the people aren't speaking to each other and are just very, very, decided to go their separate ways for one reason or another, or different, fundamentally different goals. So otherwise, it's just a way of sort of setting, making sure everybody's on the same page and communicating throughout the course of the representation.
Rick, do you have both the employer and the employee sign your engagement letter representation agreement?
I do, yes. I have them both sign it. Now, often you are starting with an employer, and really there aren't employees at that point in time where you're signing on for the representation. But when it comes to then they want to do H-1Bs, let's say, then we would want either a separate agreement that refers to the employer agreement or a document that references the dual representation. In other words, on paper, we want to make sure that employer and employee understand that neither one can present us with information that I cannot convey to the other throughout the course of the engagement. And those issues do come up, so such as when the employee wants to tell me that he's going to quit and go to work for another employer, or the employer says, gee, we're going to terminate this person. If those scenarios occur, I've got to let them know that we have a dual representation at this point. Either they need to come together and communicate with each other, or I've got to simply withdraw from the representation.
So you tell them up front that you're going to have to share all information that you receive so that they know not to tell you something if they don't want the other to know it. That is
correct.
Okay. I know in our practice, even though we may have said that up front, sometimes a call will come in and we know that it's an employee on the phone it's an employee on the phone who's going to tell me or ask me about what happens if he wants to move across the country and work someplace else. And I've been in the situation where I will get on the phone, and before I allow them to speak, I reiterate that agreement that we've all made, that anything they tell me, I've got to tell the employer, just to be sure that they have another chance not to say anything in case they forgot that I had that duty to disclose anything, both ways.
And it can get dicey. You can have the employee contact you and say, gee, my wife has just been transferred, and I may have to move to another city, something like that. Well, is that something that you need to disclose, or is that just iffy enough that you basically remain silent? You've just got to use good judgment in those contexts, and it's not always easy to know what you should do.
Yeah, that's true. Tom, what are all the rules that immigration attorneys need to be familiar with? We all know that there are ABA model rules and individual state rules and opinions. Is that all we need to review?
Well, the Executive Office of Immigration Review, for Immigration Review, has issued regulations which look like ABA model rules light. They don't cover all the topics that are covered by the ABA model rules, but when you're dealing with the EOIR and the judges that at the DOJ that handle immigration matters, that those regulations are things that you need to look at. Those are codified at 8 CFR section 1003.102. The Department of Homeland Security, in a sort of rare sort of helpful thing for attorneys in the immigration space, rather than sort of going off and doing their own version of the rules, they simply adopted them, the ones that are promulgated by the EOIR, and you can see that at 8 CFR 292.3 section B. That doesn't mean that simply because you're appearing in front of a immigration judge, you want to forget about your state rules. So it's a process where you first sort of look at all of them, and if they point in different directions, that's something where you ought to get a little advice and talk to people about how to handle that situation. Generally speaking, that doesn't occur that often. It may occur in situations, in some difficult situations, where you said something that you thought was true to an immigration court or in connection with an application to DHS, and you later find out that it's not true, and you know, how you have to handle that is something that there's variance among the states. And there's also, your state may be different from how the immigration regulations that I've just recited handle it. That's the hardest situation, and it's one that you really need to stop, take a breath, sit down, talk to somebody else, look at the regulations, do some research, and before you act. It's a hard situation even for those of us who spend a lot of time in this field.
And I think that we're going to talk about a kind of real-world hypothetical situation where that's going to come into play in a few minutes. I would also point out to those listening to the podcast that AILA has had many sessions at conferences and podcasts and webinars on dual representation and ethical considerations, especially with dual representation. So take a look on Agora if you want more on that particular issue, and see what's available on recordings and also in publications. There have been a number of articles written on dual representation that are quite helpful about how to deal with some of this employer-employee conflict and in family immigration. Okay, let's start out and talk about some real-world hypotheticals here. And these are challenging clients who you may wish that you had never taken on, but now you're stuck with them. And what are you going to do when these scenarios come up? So the first situation is regarding Chipo Corporation, who you've been representing for several years. And Chipo Corporation is a classic skinflint client. They pay low wages. They may pass fees on to their employee, and you find out about this. So although Chipo Corporation has been a slow payer to you over the years, with encouragement, they usually eventually pay their bills. You've had PERM labor certifications, I-140 petitions, and adjustment applications already approved for three employees and their families of Chipo Corporation. So you've already filed and have finished certain applications. Then you have two PERM applications pending at the Department of Labor for them. You filed several H-1B petitions for Chipo. Your bookkeeper, and you think things are going fine, although you don't get paid on time necessarily, but your bookkeeper reports to you that she made a collections call to Chipo to talk about your outstanding bill for work on the H-1Bs and labor certifications, and somebody new in accounting talked to her and apologized for being behind in payments, and that person explained that Chipo was waiting for their employees, these H-1Bs and labor certification employees, potential employees, to bring in checks for the filing fees and their contribution toward the legal fees. Now, Rick, is this something that these employees can pay? And as the attorney, would you have discussed this with Chipo before you ever agreed to represent them in filing H-1Bs and labor certifications?
We are very careful to explain to the employer that, in fact, the employer has to pay the filing fees and the attorney's fees for both an H-1B and a PERM. If a premium processing fee is available, that can be paid by the employee. But otherwise, it has to be paid by the employer. And we actually like to ask for evidence of that. when they're signing off on various documents that are presented to them. It's very important that we do that, and if we then get wind one way or another that may not have occurred, either from the employee or from this employee that you say has been late in paying our bills, then we want to investigate that with the employer and find out. And if, in fact, that is accurate, they need to make changes. That gets into the issue of how long has this been going on? Is this an H-1B we've had for a year or one that was just filed? At some point, you may have the necessity of going back to the tribunal if you can't go ahead and internally make the corrections where it just simply was an accounting mistake.
So if you've got this is a true nightmare that could come to light for an attorney when they believe that they have notified the client of their obligation to pay these fees, and then they find out after approval of all the stages of permanent residence, the labor certification and the petition and the adjustment application, that the employee paid fees that they were prohibited from paying. Do you go back to the tribunal at that point? Do you ask the employer questions to make absolutely sure that you understand what was done? How do you counsel all of these parties, the employee doesn't even work there anymore?
I think it's a judgment call. I think if the employee's not working there anymore, and you're the new attorney for the company, I'm not sure that I would make disclosures to the tribunal at that point. I just make sure that going forward they're doing things correctly. If it's one, though, that it truly is, it's an accounting mistake or somewhere in the line, mistakes can be made and it can be rectified, then I think they could go ahead and make the corrections, make sure that those payments are refunded and you document it correctly so that if there is a Department of Labor or other audit, they can see that a mistake was made, but in fact that mistake was corrected. Now, if there are a dozen H-1Bs, the employer, doesn't want to do any of the refunds, that's a harder type of issue, and those people are still working for the employer, then now you're getting not just close, but I think you do have an obligation to notify the tribunal, because the underlying premise is that you've promised to pay a prevailing wage or the actual wage of the place of employment. If you're requiring a number of fees, filing fees and lawyer's fees, then basically the theory is that reduces what the actual salary is for that employee. So at that point, I think, notification of the tribunal may be necessitated.
So one takeaway, I think, from what you're saying is that if you have all the facts, you may be able to fix the situation. But if you don't have the facts, there's no way that you can address all that's been going on. It's sort of like what we always tell our paralegals. If you come across a mistake, come and tell me as quickly as you can, because I might be able to fix it, even though you don't think I'll be able to fix it. Tom, how does an attorney try to cover themselves not to be responsible for a situation like this?
Well, I think it gets back to communication. You have to communicate with the client, and then we all have clients that we're very comfortable with. We've represented for a long time, and we do a lot of things over the phone. That's all fine, but I do think that for important principles, important issues, and when you think that there may be a problem, you need to have the oral conversations you have sort of documented with an email or a letter or something, so that it's clear what you're advising the client to do and how you're doing it. And you want to write those emails and those things carefully, because you don't want them to sort of serve as independent evidence of wrongdoing if it's later on there's an outside investigation. But you do want to make it your position clear in terms of your advice to your client about what they do, what they have to do, and what they can't do. So I think that's the sort of best way to approach it. When you get to the point of you think the client has done some things that are not consistent with the rules, and you're thinking about making a disclosure or so forth, then I think you really need to kind of focus in on the rules and be able to point to a section of the ethics rules that you believe govern your conduct that allows you to make the kind of disclosures and against your client's interests that you are contemplating making. And that sort of a generalized sense of sort of right and wrong is something that I think it's always good to have that, but it's often not enough in these situations, both in terms of how you advise your client as to what to do and what not to do, and also when the client persists in a course of action that you think is maybe illegal, may violate the regulations, and so forth. I mean, for give you an example of what from what the hypothetical we've just been discussing, is there an obligation to when you come in to a situation and you find out that a number of employees who've gotten their H-1Bs in the past have sort of paid their legal fees, which is improper, but the proceedings are over. Is there an obligation under the rules to make a disclosure? The ABA rules say that your disclosure obligations of frauds on the tribunal are cabined by the duration of the proceeding before the tribunal. So when the tribunal proceeding is over, you don't have any more obligation to make a disclosure. You can't, as a lawyer, sort of avoid making a disclosure because you know about something and you just wait for the case to end. But if you come in after the case is over, that may be a relevant situation. But then, the ABA rules are model rules, and they don't necessarily govern your particular conduct in your state, and they're the rules promulgated by the ethics authorities in at the DOJ and DHS are something you need to look at in addition to your own state's rules.
And additionally, if you are representing the company long term and these employees do stay with the company, you may represent them in the H-1B situation and find out after the fact that something was paid improperly or something was done improperly, and then the company wants to hire you to ultimately get permanent residence for the employee. And at that point, the employee is going to be asked if they've ever committed fraud to gain an immigration benefit. The employee may not be the one who committed fraud there, but so even if that first representation, scope of representation ends, something that you know from that representation might influence future representation as well, and you can't disregard that, when it comes to the next thing on the list.
So sometimes, let me just say this, sometimes, stepping back from this a little bit, that looking at it from the perspective of the lawyer and not of the client, sometimes the most important and the best decisions that you make are not taking on a representation. So we're going to wind through a number of scenarios where the client is sort of doing some things that sort of push the envelope. And as a lawyer, you want to say to yourself, is this a client who's, their own wanderings from the laws and the regulations outside the scope of what perhaps they should be doing? Is this something I want to get involved in? Or in the same way, is this a client who I really tried to work with to bring into compliance, but it's not working, and maybe it's a client you need to stop working for.
Right. Good point. Okay, let's move on to another difficult kind of client, and this is the anxious client who needs the employee right now, and whether there is an immigration status approved or not, they need them right now. So your new client is PharmaTech Startup, and they want to hire a pharmacy school graduate, Ms. Pilla Popper, who's developed a novel process for faster flu vaccine production. So you can tell why they need her right now. Unfortunately, Ms. Popper just maxed out all of her possible F1 student post-completion optional practical training time, and the time is inappropriate for H-1B cap-gap relief. So in other words, there's no way that she can start to work for PharmaTech Startup quickly, and H-1B, you find, is the only status for which she will qualify in this particular situation. So you advise Pharma that Ms. Popper has to go back home, but she can visit the company on visa waiver to discuss certain logistical matters, but you warn against unauthorized work. Now, every time your office calls PharmaTech, Pilla Popper answers the phone. PharmaTech insists that she's in the U.S. visiting her boyfriend, and she just stops by the office now and then. Keep in mind that PharmaTech is a brand-new startup and only has 10 employees. PharmaTech wants to hire you for a number of additional immigration matters, and you can see the dollar signs rolling, and you really need their business. So you've got your paralegals and even you know too saying that, gee whiz, it sounds like Pilla's over there at this company every time we call over there, and you need to figure out whether PharmaTech's telling you the truth. Rick, how do you push PharmaTech on that? Do you take their word for it that she's not actually working there, or how far do you have to investigate that question?
Well, I think you have to investigate it, and really two things there. Back to Tom's comment, you know, there's certain clients you just shouldn't take on. If I think that they are not only pushing the envelope, but they're not truthful with me, then maybe I really don't want to take them on, or I want to end the relationship right there. The second point is that we like to inform our client right off the bat, both their obligation to verify employees as well as the difference between employment authorization and business. As we know as immigration attorneys, there is this huge gray area between the ability of a person to come here on a B1 type business purpose, to go to conferences, to talk to existing clients, to visit a supplier, participate in litigation, et cetera. But you can't, you shouldn't be developing new clients. You shouldn't be doing work, creating contracts, that sort of thing while you are here. Now, we also like to explain the difference in volunteers. Can a person like Pilla Popper come and answer the phone while she's here visiting relatives or neighbors? There's nothing wrong with that if she truly is going over there just periodically and not being paid. Even if at the front desk of this small company they actually have just an unpaid volunteer who helps with that periodically, then if Pilla Popper is acting as a volunteer, fine. But if it's normally a paid employee who's on vacation, then, in fact, you can't. That's unauthorized employment. We had a situation a number of years ago where a cousin comes to visit, and his cousin owned an Italian restaurant. He puts on an apron and busses some tables because he was there for 6 weeks and didn't want to just stay back in the apartment. He truly wasn't paid, wasn't trying to work. Unfortunately, some INS agents came and had lunch there and started just casually visiting with him. At the end of the day, the employer is fine. And even though the employer tried to explain the situation, unfortunately, if it looks and smells like employment, the government typically, if they find out about it, is going to consider it employment. So it's very important at the very beginning for the employer to understand what they can and can't do. Then if you find out they're not following the rules, you've really got to consider whether you want to continue to represent them.
So you determined that Pilla actually is working without authorization at PharmaTech, and probably committed fraud when she entered on visa waiver, because she's been in and out of the country for the last six, out of the U.S. for the last 6 months. And every time she comes in, she continues to go back and answer the phone and do some other things. So you have a question about whether she's committing fraud at entry. What do you have to do with that information, that knowledge, with future applications as well? Let's say she gets her H-1B, but again, you know that Pharmatech wants to eventually try to obtain a labor certification for her, and she's probably going to apply for permanent residence, but there's this fraud in the past. How do you deal with that information, this knowledge?
Well, if you're handling the H-1B petition and the employer is following the rules, or if it's subsequently the perm, I don't think that that as long as the employer and employee are following those rules at that point in time, I don't see a problem with it. I would want to make sure in my engagement letter that, in fact, both employer and employee will tell the truth, including any disclosures of potential fraud. When it comes to the adjustment of status, then those questions of fraud are specifically asked on the form. Depending upon the particular situation, if she didn't feel that, if she really didn't feel she was committing fraud, she was really coming to visit relatives, this kind of came up at the end, then maybe she can say no. You just have to question her, and it's her decision on that. If it is clearly fraud, she should check the box that it is fraudulent, and hope that it is covered as basically an immaterial type of fraud that isn't going to harm either the H-1. Well, you're not going to have it so much, and you will have it if let's say she's going to the consul or the change of status, but you're not going to have it on the green card until the adjustment. We have in the past even you check the box no, but you put an asterisk and you make a disclosure as to what has happened, but that the person doesn't feel that it was fraud.
Yeah, we've done that on occasion also. We might check the box, but then we disclose everything, but explain why we don't believe it's fraud or why that person didn't think that they were committing fraud. Tom, can you comment on limiting the scope of employment in your representation letter and why that's so important?
Limiting the scope of what the lawyer...
Of your representation.
That's accepted, and that is you can find the rules talk about that. You can't divide up a representation into sort of unnatural parts where you'll do the first part of the H-1B process, but then you'll get out of the second part. Now, maybe there's ways that you will tell me as immigration lawyers that's a natural dividing line. But you need to be careful that what you're doing is not sort of leaving the client in a situation where it's they've got continuing obligations or continuing things they need to do in order to they haven't achieved anything, and you've just sort of written their, gotten them gotten them halfway through. So the notion is that the limitations on the representation have to be either reasonable under the circumstances, that's the ABA formulation, or should not preclude competent representation. That's an alternative formulation.
And how that applies.
Go ahead.
Well, no, I was just going to say. So it seems that you would judge whether it was reasonable in the practice to be engaged to prepare and file a non-immigrant visa application under one scope of employment agreement, and then if they come back to you and want you to, which is totally separate, pursue permanent residence for the employee, that would be a separate scope of employment and separate agreement, is it?
You know, I think that makes a lot of sense for the lawyer, because the the two matters may be separated in with a great deal of space and time, and I think you want to be. I don't think the client wants to be in a situation where they're paying for something that the permanent resident application, which, as I understand it, can happen, you know, well after the other one.
Yes.
Years later, is that right? So I don't think the client wants to be paying for that, or that you want to set the price of that now. Why? Well, you should that. Yeah, so I would say let's do what you want to accomplish to, you know, now, which is getting your non-immigrant visa, and then later, if you want to come back to us and for a permanent residency application, that will be a separate matter.
Rick,
so it's important to communicate to clients who have varying degrees of sophistication and whom bar counsel also will regard as being unsophisticated, even if they are very sophisticated. Just sort of communicate to them clearly for the lawyer's protection that what you're doing and that you're not going to do. So I'm going to do your non-immigrant visa, but I'm not going to do your permanent residency application.
Mm-hmm. Again, it comes back to that representation agreement being clear. Mm-hmm. So, Rick, if you represent a corporation over the years and they regularly bring in H-1Bs and they regularly turn them over into perms and permanent residents, do you have two separate retainer agreements for the two separate types of applications that you're pursuing, even though it's the same company?
What we do, what we call our general engagement letter, basically says that you hire us, you tell the truth, and you'll pay your bills, okay? We reference in there that we may have fixed fee agreements that are separate from the general representation. So if we are then hired to do whatever, H-1Bs, we will define everything from how we will price things, but more importantly, the scope of work. I used to do a lot of construction law, and it's very well defined in construction law that you use these AIA contracts and you define the scope of work. You say, this is what we are going to do, and this is what we are not going to do. And that's what we try to do and look at, and while we kind of have forms of those for the various visas, we have to look at it for each particular case because there's some things, let's just use requests for evidence, RFEs, for example. Generally, we will completely exclude any RFEs because I don't have a clue at the time I'm filing as to what that RFE might be and what we'll have to do to cover it. Sometimes we'll include one RFE. So it may vary from client to client as to what we'll include and exclude, but we try to talk about those things at the beginning, particularly if, in fact, it is a fixed fee. Because we do have some clients that are totally hourly and some that are fixed fees and some where it's actually mixed, where some of the general representation is on an hourly, but then we come up with something we can get our arms around where we can, in fact, define the scope of work properly, and then we will provide them with a fixed fee agreement. So that is separate. It may come, 6 months after they've signed the general agreement, and then we'll have this fixed fee agreement, and then there may be several more over time, as we march through the process, say from H-1B to perm to adjustment of status or whatever it is.
Another particular type of obligation has recently arisen for immigration lawyers. We have the ABA rules, we have our state rules, we have DHS and EOIR regulations, DOL regulations, and now we have the immigration CIS forms that are obligating us even further. There have been significant changes recently on new editions of CIS forms, placing a higher duty on attorneys in the preparer's declaration. And let me just read this new language that is being used on most new forms and is going to continue to be used, apparently, as the forms are updated. AILA has written comments to this to indicate concern about overreaching in this language, but to date it's still there. So the language is, for the preparer, by my signature I certify, swear, or affirm under penalty of perjury that I prepared this form on behalf of, at the request of, and with the express consent of the petitioner. And this is the language straight from the H-1B form, or from the 129. I completed the form based only on responses the petitioner provided to me. After completing the form, I reviewed it and all of the petitioner's responses with the petitioner, who agreed with every answer provided for every question on the form, and when required, supplied additional information to respond to a question on the form. AILA has published a really great practice pointer regarding this new preparer's declaration on April 8th, 2015, that you can download from from AILA.org, I guess it is now, and suggesting different ways that attorneys might choose to deal with this preparer's declaration. These different ways range from submitting a G-28 but not signing the preparer's declaration, to fully complying with this preparer's declaration and changing the procedures in your office so that you know that you're fully complying, and then also having the client sign similar language for your own benefit, indicating that you did everything to comply with this preparer's declaration. Rick, has your office changed your procedures yet, or are you still looking into it? We're still, you know, trying to figure out exactly the best way to handle this, and we're certainly talking further to clients and just covering our bases more thoroughly with the forms that they're signing. But is your office changing your procedures to deal with this new language?
We also are in the process of both digesting and making decisions. We've got a pretty decent process in place where we prepare the form, we send it to the petitioner, we have them review it and get back to us, and then we finalize it. However, you know, here, this, where it says, after completing the form, I reviewed it, and all of the petitioner's responses who agreed with every answer provided for every question on the form. I don't like that language. What I think we're going to end up doing is to have a separate piece of paper that completely states this, have our paralegals make sure that they do go over the questions with the petitioner. Now, let's face it, sometimes, and H-1B is a perfect example where, you're in a hurry. You may be trying to meet a deadline, and it may be very difficult to fully comply with the statement. We also know that some attorneys have crossed out some of the language, but it has been sent back to the attorneys. So, I mean, obviously, unless we get them to change this language, we're going to have to accept it. So, you know, my sense is that we will probably do our very best to follow what we swear to that we're doing, and have our process as close as possible, and have the client sign a separate document that we have, in fact, complied with it.
Do you think that by signing this, having your paralegal or other office staff actually perform the action of going over the questions, each and every question with the client, is that going to be enough, or does the attorney have to be the one to do it?
Well, one of the options that AILA is recommending is that you might have the paralegal sign the declaration. It doesn't necessarily shift the obligation. It's still the attorney's obligation. However, if the paralegal is the agent of the attorney, and in fact you're showing, law offices of Richard A. Gump Jr., regardless of who may sign it, the I in there, I think it should be interpreted, we don't know, it should be interpreted differently from, let's say, the I-9. We know for a fact that the government says that the individual who takes the I-9 must visually be in front of the individual and visually review the documents. You can't have someone else sign the I-9. Will this be interpreted the same way? I wouldn't think so. I would think that it would be the law office. But it says, by my signature, I certify. So, you know, it's another complicating factor if, in fact, you have the paralegal do it.
But a good idea having them sign, because you're not trying necessarily to get out of your obligation. You just want to accurately sign the form and not have it come back up later. Do you see this kind of oversight with other types of practices, Tom, or is this, do you think, unique to the government regulating immigration law, micromanaging immigration?
I think immigration is a fairly, it's got a lot of government focus and scrutiny. And a lot of the stuff that I'm dealing with are lawyers who are sort of handling matters between private parties. And so you don't have this overlay of government regulation and how you have to do it.
I think it's
worse. Immigration is really among the areas that is sort of most highly regulated. And for whatever reason, the government seems to be concerned about people saying things that are not true and making false representations and trying to take steps to address that. So I think immigration is pretty high up there in terms of government scrutiny.
I know we feel like we're getting a new requirement thrown at us at every turn. Okay, well, let's move on to a different hypothetical, different scenario problem in your office. So you're still representing Pharmatech, and you've gotten to be pretty good friends now with the president of Pharmatech because you've had so many conversations with them over Pillow Popper's employment prohibition. The president shares with you that he's having some financing problems at the company, and he's looking for investors. Based on what you know about Pharmatech and Pillow Popper's vaccine production research, you believe that the company's in for a windfall in a few years, and you readily offered to invest $250,000 into the company, and you agree to recruit other investors from your investment club because you think it's such a great deal. Rick, is this a good idea, and is it common for lawyers to invest in their clients' businesses? Do you see this, and where do you draw the line between your own benefit to yourself and benefit to your company, to the client and the company?
Well, it can be, you know, a great windfall if Pharmatech does well and you make a lot of friends, or you might lose a lot of money and lose a lot of friends as well as the client and then have the ethics committee coming after you. It's whether or not it affects your objectivity. There is no prohibition to doing it. It's one of those issues and a lot of lawyers who don't have direct conflicts do it. There are a number of large firms who actually form subsidiaries where the partners may invest in particular clients if they want to do it. But if it in terms of reporting things to the tribunal, or if you are representing the board, if there are things that you're not telling the board that you ought to be telling the board because you don't want them to know it, you really put yourself in a very difficult position where perhaps, you really need to read the conflict of interest rules, and at least ABA is, 1.7, and decide whether that's something that is a good idea or not. It also plays out in accepting part of your fee. With stock in the company. The company's short on cash, but it'll give you some stock. You know, that's another issue that can come up. And I just think you have to be, again, you've got to use good judgment, and you know, it may well be that you want to go ahead and do it because you think it's a good deal, and if it looks like objectively it's going to be a problem, you'd rather give up your representation of the company than the stock. So, again, I think it's just something that on a case-by-case basis has to be reviewed.
How do you separate?
Go ahead, Tom.
I'm sorry.
There's a specific ABA rule on this that you got to be very careful to address, which is 1.8A. And it has various – it says the deal has to be objectively fair and reasonable. You have to make certain disclosures to the client, like you should get a lawyer. The client has to sort of provide written consent to this. And the courts do not are not particularly lenient in these situations where a lawyer has not complied with these rules or the procedures that they talk about. And they've told lawyers, you know, too bad, you know, you forfeit your interest. So we're not going to give you the fair value of what you got. We're not going to reform it. We're not going to sort of give you what you should have gotten as a fee if you didn't take this. You know, you were the lawyer. You were in the fiduciary position. You had superior knowledge, and you get nothing. So this is an area where I think there is a lot of danger for the lawyer, and the ethics rules are quite clear and quite stringent.
And who is the attorney's duty to? Is the attorney's duty to his friend, the president of the company, or is the duty to the company who is the client? And who is the client situation?
That's always a question you should be asking yourself at all points during your work. Who is the client? It strikes me in this situation that if you're giving the president a personal loan and he's putting in the thing and he's putting it in, that's a business transaction. Still, I think a business transaction with someone in that's part of a client, but it's probably not the client. But if you're making a direct investment into the organization that you're representing, they're the client. But you come back to your engagement letter and you come back to the work that you're doing. Who did you identify as the client in your engagement letter? Was it the president or was it the organization? And who have you represented to the government that you are you're providing legal, you know, that you're their lawyer? If you sign a piece of paper, that you send in a piece of paper to the government saying I'm the lawyer for X, then you're the lawyer for X, regardless of whether you've put them down in your engagement letter or not.
And Tom, in the real world, in immigration, you do become friends with often the clients, the individual, as opposed to the entity, those who are running the entity. In a non-immigration context, I had a very close friend who, in fact, went to prison and lost his law license, and he was a very good attorney, but he became close friends with the president of a regulated utility, and that friend wanted him to increase the legal fees for this large law firm charged so that a couple of consultants could be paid. Without really diving into it, he just accepted that order from the president, and it ended up all in the newspapers. It basically ruined his career as an attorney. So I think your point is well taken. You know, who is your client? You know, is it the entity or is it the president? And you better keep those relationships very separate.
It also gives you a basis to say to your friend, the president, I can't do what you're asking me to do. in an uncomfortable situation. I can't do this because I don't represent you. I represent your company. Sometimes it's helpful to have a rule to fall back on, or some limitation, legal limitation, when it is uncomfortable to say to somebody, I can't do this anymore, or I can't do this particular thing you want me to do.
I had an HR person pay me to evaluate an order that she was asked to do by the president of the company, and it was clearly illegal and fraudulent, and so she did the right thing. She quit the company, and of course there are lawyers who, particularly if you're in-house, there are times when you just simply cannot do what you are ordered to do because it is it's improper.
Okay, thanks for that. All right, moving on to another type of client that we all have run into, the non-compliant, I think they certainly are out there, the non-compliant client that fails to follow the rules either intentionally or just because they don't pay attention and they're neglectful. So again, you're going back to your new best friend, the president of Pharmatech, and you're having lunch with him, and the topic of paperwork completion when hiring new employees comes up. Pharma president says, well, hiring new employees, gosh, I think that the high school intern at the front desk takes care of having new employees complete government forms. I guess I should look into that. Now, you know that you sent the company a package of instructions regarding I-9 completion and retention of I-9s and the obligation to maintain other files related to H-1Bs and labor certifications. The president says he thinks Larry, the new office manager, was given the employee files by Linda, the person who just quit. And then the president of Pharmatech says, now tell me again what documents I'm supposed to keep and where we're supposed to do this and how I make sure to cover all of my bases. So this lunch has you very concerned that Pharmatech has totally neglected to keep its forms in order, both its I-9s and the files it has to maintain for business clients that you filed, for the clients that you have filed immigration applications for. How do you avoid this? You send your client the documentation that tells them what they need to be doing, and you set it out very specifically. You try not to use a lot of legalese. You use big bullet points and bold type and all the rest of it. But how do you make sure that they are taking care of these requirements that you're telling them to do, and also cover yourself so that if they come back and say, well, you never told me, you can show them that, yes, I did?
At the beginning of any engagement, we always bring up the verification, the I-9 issue, because particularly if you're doing H-1Bs or PERMs or whatever, if they're not doing the other regulatory requirements, then there can be serious problems and fines. We don't just send them a packet of materials. We actually typically will send a person out or have their employee come here and train them and make sure that they are doing it correctly, and then audit them at some point thereafter, because we just know that it can cause them problems down the road if they're not following those procedures. We just this week had a client that we've been working with for 6-8 months to prepare an investor visa, and we're finding that the entity really has not been following the I-9 rules. So I sent the lawyer and the paralegal out there to fully train them and make sure that they comply, because you can end up with really some terrible problems down the road if you don't do that. So I think it's incredibly important at the very beginning. If you find out later, then you've got to make sure that they're going in and doing the right thing. If they won't do it, then at some point you need to think whether you want to continue to represent them. I had an IT company a number of years ago that was not going to follow what I asked them to do, and I basically fired them as a client, and glad that I did, because a few weeks later the FBI was in their office with a further investigation of a number of employment violations. You just don't need clients that are not going to follow your advice. It's just life is too short, your license is too important.
Tom, how far does your duty as the attorney extend to checking up behind your client to make sure that they're following these requirements that you told them about?
Well, you know, I think in the immigration context, there's a lot of, you know, you're having a lot of, the client's having a lot of interaction with the government. You may be a part of that. And so, you know, their lack of compliance is going to at some point intersect with some of the things that you're doing on their behalf with the government, or could. So I think that it's an area where I think your own duties are going to be, you know, pretty much that they got a couple of chances to sort of bring themselves into general compliance with the basics of the regulatory scheme that the government imposes on them. And if they don't, you should be in a situation where you're not representing them anymore. The ethics rules say that you cannot counsel or assist a client in order to commit a crime or a fraud. And there are other parts of the ethics rules which talk about your services being used to further a crime or fraud. And we've all been in situations where we've given advice to someone and we think that advice is good advice and we've helped them, and then all of a sudden we've learned that they've sort of taken a different path and done things that they shouldn't have do, and that somehow, even innocently, our own advice is sort of enmeshed in that. And when you discover that, it is a time when you want to be, you want to get out, and you don't want to be part of, don't want to continue the representation, and then you have to confront the issue about whether they're disclosures, affirmative disclosures you have to make. I'm not going to be your lawyer anymore.
And it's another reason to go in every year and re-audit the client, because they often fall off the wagon in terms of compliance, and it's really a good idea to bring up those issues every year to make sure they're in immigration compliance.
Yeah, and I just want to...
The people who you talked to last year who understood how these forms had to be done, you know, they've either gotten promoted or moved somewhere else, and you've got new people. And it just sort of happens, you know, by the passage of time, even when the people who you've trained are still there, that their familiarity with the rules and the compliance, it just sort of leaked out of their brain in one way or the other. The way it happens to all of us is why we have programs like this that are called continuing legal education, because there are a lot of things that we once knew that we've forgotten and that we need to be reminded of.
So I think that the point to be sure to remember from that discussion is that you can't just send a memo and a voluminous package of documents to a client telling them what to do and assume that they do it correctly and that you never have to bring it up again. Okay, last client is the unsatisfied client who's disputing your bill and threatening complaints to the state bar and to online attorney sites, that kind of thing. In this situation, we're back to CHIPO that insisted that you file a national interest waiver petition, even though you said that it was a long shot. And when you received an RFE, or when they received an RFE, you suggested withdrawing the petition rather than spending more hours on the project, but they insisted that you continue. The National Interest Waiver petition has been denied, and the adjustment applications that were concurrently filed have been denied. CHIPO refuses to pay your bill for preparing the RFE response. They want you to reimburse the employee for the I-485 filing fees, and say that they're going to turn you into the state bar, and on top of everything else, it took 18 months longer than you promised it would take. So, should your retainer agreement, to start with, address fee disputes? And what do you do when the fee dispute comes up? What do you do when the fee dispute comes up?
Well, I think, go ahead, Tom.
Well, I just had a view on this stuff. You shouldn't be in a situation where a particular client is going to sort of make or break your professional career. And when I get in fee disputes, most of the time I say, you know, pay me what you think is fair and we're done, right? Or we're done. It's a lot easier to do that. Now you may, you know, and you are for me to be able to do that, you have to manage your AR in a reasonable way so that you're never in a situation where someone owes you, you know, so much money that you're, it's going to make a significant impact on your practice if they don't pay. You should be on top of your AR in advance of that so that you're in a position where the client says to you, this is too expensive, or you've charged too much. My advice to my clients is, and what I've done in my own practice, is say, fine, you know what, we're done. Let me know who your new counsel is. If you can get yourself to that position, I promise you, you will be better off than spending a lot of time in arbitrations. Engendering malpractice suits and encouraging bar complaints. And the issue with the bar complaints is you can settle a fee dispute. You can say, well, we agree that, you know, I'll pay you this half of what you, you know, split it down the middle. But you can't, as part of that discussion, part of that agreement, prevent them from getting from filing a bar complaint. You can never get a release that covers the bar complaint. You can't do it.
Rick, if you want to pull out early from representing the client in the middle of having filed an application or a petition that's very, very complicated, do you have to worry about hurting the client even if you're not being paid?
Yeah, you absolutely do. You need to anticipate these problems as early as you can so that when you pull out, it is at an appropriate time that's not going to cause a problem for the client. It's worse, obviously, in an immigration court where you really can't just pull out in the middle without the approval of the court. That's also true as you're going through whatever it is, the green card process. If you don't answer an RFE, that client is in trouble. And so you really have to be careful and not leave the client in a position where something isn't answered properally and the client doesn't have time to get new counsel. So I agree totally with Tom. I mean, if you haven't handled it at the beginning, then you need to just take the price that the client thinks is fair. That is exactly what we do. And then in terms of ending the representation, you just need to look at it carefully and make sure that you're not putting the client in a bad way.
If you decide to perform an extra piece of work that you didn't originally include in your retainer agreement, is there any problem with amending the engagement letter to change the scope of employment? Say you didn't include an RFE response in it. Can you add that later to cover yourself for payment and scope of employment?
We do that all the time. It's just like a change order in a construction contract. You absolutely can do that, and you basically have either an amended agreement. Again, we have this general agreement that refers to any future agreements that we may have. So if we have a new agreement, we just sign off on it. We're going to respond to the RFE, and here's how we're going to manage the fees on it. And you can have changes. You never, particularly in immigration, you don't quite know what's going to happen. Even things like, well, you know, I need now to bring my mother in, or I mean, things that weren't contemplated in the original scope. And, you know, you need to have those discussions along the way with the client. And to be fair to the client and to yourself, make sure that you are having a new or amended retainer agreement to cover that so that everybody's on the same page as to how that process is going to evolve and how you're going to get paid.
Thank you both so much. Go ahead, Tom. I'm sorry.
No, one of the things that's important is that you avoid the situation where your amendment could be look like simply a price increase for doing the same work that you agreed to at the beginning. And that's why you want to make sure that you describe what you do, what you at the beginning, what you're going to do for the price that they're going to pay with sufficient specificity. So if something new comes along, it's clear that that's an add-on that wasn't originally envisioned. But if you're,
if you're
too general about it, then the client can say, well, you're just increasing the price. You said you would do this for $2,000. Now you're saying you're going to do it for $5,000. And those are called novations, and they're discouraged. Sort of mid-representation price increases are discouraged.
That's a great point. Thank you both so much. I think our time is up, but it sounds like the most important things that we've discussed are being upfront with your client, getting that retainer agreement, getting the scope of work specifically included in the agreement, and communication, constantly communicating with the client to make sure that things are going as you expect them to go. So thank you. And I'm going to turn it back over to JJ Area.
Thanks, Lynn. For those of you who will be seeking CLE credit for your participation in this podcast, please make note of the following four-digit attendance verification code. The four-digit code is 3085. Again, the code is 3085. Please visit AILA's Web CLE Center at www.ailawebcle.org to record your CLE credits. Thank you very much to all of our speakers for sharing their wonderful knowledge and expertise, and to you for joining us today. That concludes our podcast.